found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Heels and Wheels is back. We're raising money for Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Join us for a ride, lunch, and a souvenir t-shirt and a donation to the cause this Sunday. Registration is just $40, and the money you help us raise helps women in our community who may be underprivileged, uninsured, or underinsured. All women, all riders. Registration is at 8:30. Kickstands up at 10 a.m. Roll into Ventura Harley-Davidson in Camarillo this Sunday and join the cause. Visit MariaSanchezShow.com. For event details and register online right now. Join us this Sunday morning for the 8th annual Heels and Wheels, a women's motorcycle ride in support of Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Proudly supported by Ventura Harley-Davidson, Grand Marshal Maria Sanchez, and News Talk 1590 KBTA.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. We're live on Thursday, July 11th, as we are every weekday morning right here at latalkradio.com, and then later on during the day for download at mariasanchezshow.com. And thank you for joining us. And thank you to Bob Allen, Spence, and KBTA 1590 for making that public service announcement available to us. We do appreciate the honor, and we love the support that we've been getting. So we want you to join us. It's this Sunday. It is at the Ventura Harley-Davidson dealership, which is actually in the city of Camarillo. We are getting folks from Orange County, Riverside County, Los Angeles County, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, San Luis Obispo. It's Central Coast. So please come and join us. It couldn't be for a better cause. If you don't ride a bike, you may ride your car, drive your car. So you'd be bringing up the rear with the gals who are on the bikes, and I'm going to be following the road captain, and then the rest of the gals will be following behind. The first time I was the Grand Marshal was year number two. I had just bought my bike that year from, actually, Ventura Harley-Davidson. And everyone gets on their bikes and rev your engines. And by the way, it's any brand of motorcycle. The only requirement is that you're female. The registration fee is $40. That includes the ride, t-shirt, lunch, and the donation to Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. So please, please join us. Again, it's this Sunday, July 14th. We would love to have you with us. We'd like to break some records with attendance and with funds raised. Now, the Heels and Wheels ride, this will be the eighth year. They've been aligned with various charities, and this relationship with Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center has been for 3 years. They've already raised $20,000. So imagine. And the Breast Center serves underserved women, uninsured women, underinsured women, and breast health, so like preventative screening mammograms, etc., as well as breast cancer issues. And they don't pay attention to immigration status or what your legal standing is in the community. They are colorblind, if you will, in that regard. So it goes to a great cause. So please join us. Again, that's Heels and Wheels, 8th Annual Sunday, and it's July 14th. So we, we have some great inspirational stories as our guests this morning. One is, our first guest is a woman who has recovered from schizophrenia. And that's pretty spectacular. She's going to share with us her story. And then we have the president and CEO of the Foster Family and Adoption Agency here in Southern California visiting with us about foster families and what we can do to help the system and become maybe a foster parent and maybe eventually adopt. So she's going to visit with us and share with their message. And then we have good news nationally also. Today, our stocks jumped because comments by U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke indicated that the central bank was unlikely to scale back its stimulus measures earlier than expected, and everyone loved that. So his latest remarks sent the dollar lower and boosted commodities such as gold and copper. Sales at U.S. retailers suggest that our overall U.S. consumer spending is improving. So, yay, Ben. Can you imagine that people, you know, like hang on for your words and then respond accordingly? Got to take that power very, very seriously. So in the other good news category, fewer U.S. homes entered the foreclosure process or were repossessed by the banks in June, the latest sign that the nation is shaking off its housing bust hangover. This is the lowest level for any month in 7.5 years. This is news today from the listing firm, foreclosure listing firm, Reality Track, Inc. Completed foreclosures, when the lender actually does take repossession of a home, are on track to hit 500,000 or about a quarter below last year's total. So the U.S. housing recovery continues to gain strength. That helps boost the home prices, which fueled the biggest gain in 7 years in May. So I love all these stories that it's the biggest this, it's the biggest that, it's the largest this. We've got 5 years, 6 years, 7.5 years. The only other problem is that there are four states, Florida, Nevada, Illinois, and Ohio, are dragging the numbers down because they're not getting the rebound as much as the rest of the country. For example, homes scheduled for auction in states like Florida were up 34% in June from a year earlier. And scheduled home auctions doubled last month in New Jersey. And they also, Florida posted the highest foreclosure rate of any state, nearly three times the national average. So the number of homes that entered the foreclosure process last month in June was down 21% from May and about 45% below June's 2012 total. At the height of the housing boom in 2006, foreclosures averaged 22,000 a month. They peaked in September of 2010 at 102,000. And they're saying about 75% of the homes in the foreclosure process as of last month are tied to loans that originated between 04 and 08. So because we have stricter requirements now, they're saying that's a good sign because lending has improved and we're not seeing high foreclosure rates on mortgages that have been taken out since 2008. And I was actually a victim of the system, if you will. I closed on my home in November of 2005. It was based on my divorce. I bought a home so that my four children and I had a place to land after the divorce. And there was a full price backup offer on my home, so I knew that I wasn't overpaying for the home, which actually was to my detriment because the sellers wanting to get more money wanted nothing to do with any of the requests that I made in terms of after the home inspection and that sort of thing. But anyway, I needed a place to land, and the home that I purchased had been previously occupied, but at the moment was empty because the sellers hadn't yet moved into it, and they found themselves owning two homes, the home that they were living in and the home that they bought, and they couldn't sell the home that they were living in, so they put both homes on the market, and by default, whichever one sold, that's where they were going to land. Well, I came along and I had a 30-day escrow because I wanted and needed a place to move my babies, and so that because it was vacant and because I had a 30-day escrow, that helped expedite my needs. So I paid, you know, it was a fair market price, obviously, if there was a higher price behind me, and I, based on our dissolution agreement, I was going to be able to pay the mortgage off from the proceeds of the home that my ex and I had co-owned. And then a series of unfortunate events unfolded, and I found myself owning a home that I couldn't really afford based on the newer circumstances. So I made my best efforts to do that and make the payments for 5 years, and I called my lender twice to initiate a loan modification process. The first time they told me that I did not have enough debt. And the second time they told me that I wasn't in arrears, that I was current with my payments. And the guy on the other end, this is his quote, he said, "You're standing on the shore telling us you're drowning, and you're not." And I was like, "Yes, but I'm pulling from savings to make the payment." And he says, "As you should. You signed an obligation to do so." So morally, of course, I knew that I did owe that. Realistically, I was not able to pay it, and I stopped making my payments. I think it was January of, I can't remember, 10, January of 10. And then the phone started ringing, and every month, this was back before they got their act together, every month I would be assigned a new person who needed me to fax in all the information that I had faxed in the prior month, and that went on for months and months, and then finally in the fall of 10, I got some gal who either had sympathy, empathy, I don't know, morally, what she just, she hung on with me. It makes me tear up to this day because I knew that I had an obligation, and that home was a sanctuary for me and my children. And the thought of losing it, you know, I mean, those of you who are listening who have lost your homes, you know what it's like. And this woman, I swear to goodness, she held my hand, and every day nearly we were in touch together. She gave me her email, which I hadn't had before. And every time she asked for a document, I jumped through a hoop to make sure that she had it like within the hour. And my body put on 30 pounds in that process, and I didn't change my eating or exercise habits at all, but that's how my body handled the stress of that. And then one day I got a notice on my door about, I think, a year into the process that said that I had to vacate the home within 72 hours because they were going to take it. This while I was in the loan modification process. And I understand that has happened to people in the past. And now it's like, oh my gosh, I got to find somewhere else where to live. So long story short, I get a call one day from her, and she says, Maria, are you in a place where you can talk? I had just gotten out of my Rotary meeting. I'll never forget it. And I said, yeah, I am. And she says, you've been approved for a loan modification. And I burst into tears. It was like, oh my goodness. So I am a product of the system that has worked for me. It required due diligence. I did not involve attorney. I did whatever they asked me to do. I faxed whatever they needed me to fax. And so I believe July 1st of 2011 was my first modified payment. So here we have a two-year anniversary of me being able to be in my home and to have a payment that's affordable and to be able to stay. So I guess my story to you is keep on keeping on, because I took the paperwork when my lender is Chase, by the way, which I have the utmost respect for, and I will try to be a Chase customer for the rest of my life. But I took the paperwork that Chase sent me to sign off on the loan modification process to a real estate attorney, because I wanted to make sure that what I thought I was signing was indeed what I was signing, because it was in all that legal jargon. And since I hadn't an involved attorney in the process, I didn't know if, you know, if they had slipped something in there or whatever. So he's got the paperwork in front of him, and he's got me in front of him, and he looks at me and he goes, Maria, how did you do this? And I said, 18 months. And you should see, my paperwork is probably about 18 inches high. And he said, I've had 100 of these. I've not had one approved. And I was like, wow. And then I called my insurance agent, because we had to redo the policy, the homeowner's policy. And I said, John, I got my loan modification. And he said, you did not. And I said, yeah, John, I did. I did. And he goes, Maria, nobody gets a loan modification. I was like, well, I did. So the system can work. The system does work. So please be persistent with whatever it is that you wish to achieve in life. And if you didn't hear our podcast yesterday with our guest, Hal, he talked about that too. So it does work. It just takes power. So speaking of which, we're going to have our first guest, Bill, visit with us. She's a mental health expert, an authority on mental illness, and author of Don't Call Me Crazy, I'm Just in Love, and Survived and Overcame Schizophrenia.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hi, good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and you're live on the Maria Sanchez Show.
Wonderful.
With Ms. Mohammed, would you please say your first name for us so I don't butcher it?
Swia.
Swia, that's beautiful. Does it have
Thank
a meaning?
You. Little one.
Little one.
Yes.
And Swia, one of the wonderful messages that you have and to me, what I'm looking forward to hearing about your plight in life and your recovery, is that there's hope.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so would you start from the beginning and how it is that you knew or what your schizophrenia was like for you and then how you were able to overcome it?
Sure. Well, when I was young, I had a dysfunctional family. When I was 5 years old, my brother molested me. And then when I was 10, I got physically abused by my stepdad. And the brother that molested me committed suicide at 23. So it's like, imagine going through all this trauma and devastation. And my I had a family history of mental illness. My grandmother had schizophrenia, and my father has mental illness. But I'm not sure what, and he doesn't take his medicine. So with all of this trauma and then stress from trying to work as a community facilitator and stress from quitting and trying to find another job, trying to get married, and so all of that, just it caused me to have a breakdown. And I started talking to myself, crying, laughing, just uncontrollable. And I got hospitalized, and the doctor set me down. They said, you have the most debilitating mental illness known in mental health, paranoid schizophrenia. And I said, no way possible. I'm not taking medicine, and I don't have it. You know, I'm normal. I have a college degree. I've never had any disciplinary problems in school. I don't have it. So I wouldn't accept it. And I was hospitalized 6 times, and my family had to actually take a picture of me when I was sick. And that's when I looked at the picture, I was like, oh, my God, you know, that's not me. I mean, and that's when I came to a realization that I needed help. And so what I tell people that have mental illness, read everything you can about your disorder, everything you can, so you can know what not to do. And that's one thing I did to help me recover. And also read as many books as you can, self-help books. My book is Don't Call Me Crazy, I'm Just in Love. You can read that. And you need a lot of self-help books because, like, I've learned power techniques to avoid arguments. Like, when I was sick, I would get into an argument with someone, and they would judge me, and I would be upset for 3 days and stressed out. And then I learned when someone makes a judgment call about you and they don't know you, they're really talking about themselves. So and you just keep quiet and let them keep talking, and then they'll tell you. And so that little power technique right there saved me from arguments and arguments. And so many things that I've learned that helped me recover.
Now, Swia, when you were diagnosed, when the doctor said that you had paranoid schizophrenia, how old were you?
I was 28.
28. And did you take medicines, or was it intermittent?
Well, I didn't have any medicine prior to that. Never been hospitalized. Never had any disciplinary problems. But when I was hospitalized, they gave me medications to take. And I would take it. And then as soon as I got out of the hospital, I stopped taking it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, one thing a lot of people do is that when a lot of people have mental illness, and I hear this all the time, they'll take their medicine for 2 years and they say, oh, I'm fine. I don't need it anymore. I'm cured. You know, then you can get off the medicine and then they'll be fine for 2 years. Then they get hospitalized again. So I warn people, you know, if you are diagnosed and you want a second opinion, sure, get one. But if you're told to take medication, take your medication. Don't get off of it just because you think you don't need it anymore. You need it, you know. So
my understanding, Swia, about your recovery is that by taking your meds, you were able to alleviate some of the more pronounced symptoms. Therefore, mm-hmm. you were able to be in a better frame of mind to learn more about yourself and to learn coping techniques, mm-hmm. which then helped you with other people and then your overall mental health.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you were enlightened in that you realized that you had a problem and then you took steps to help mm-hmm. mitigate those reactions. And what was
yes.
that one that you talked about where you realized that you were getting argumentative and then you would just back down? Or how does that work?
Yes, like I remember one person said, oh, he didn't even know me. He said, oh, you need therapy. And years ago, I would argue, and what are you talking about? You're wrong. You know, but I just didn't say anything. Let him keep talking. And then after he was done, he said, oh, I'm so stupid. And I told him, I said, you need cognitive therapy. So he was talking about himself the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's so amazing.
So what have you found your greatest reward, and what has been the biggest challenge to this day?
The biggest reward is that I've never been this excited in my life. I was chosen as a Bay News 9 Everyday Hero, and that's shown, Bay News 9 is shown in 7 counties. And I was so excited. This is like the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me. This is the first time I've ever been on, TV other than local TV, because I used to be on local TV a lot. But this was amazing. And also, my book being required reading at XTC College, which is a four-year institution, that was really amazing. I didn't even think that was possible. You know, that wasn't even one of my goals. And now I'm trying to make my book required reading for 7,000 high schools in Pinellas County. And I'm going to go to Hillsborough. I'm going to keep going until it's everywhere.
And how did you find the process of writing the book? How did you go about that on a day-to-day basis?
That, you know, it's what's amazing is what I want to tell a lot of people that have mental illness is that God is with you every step of the way. And God gave me a lot of revelation. He said I was going to be a billionaire. A movie was going to be made about my story. And I didn't have a book. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a car. I had absolutely nothing. And then so after I got hospitalized, I just started writing. I don't know where it came from, like God or spirit. I don't know. I just started writing and writing and writing. And the next thing I knew, I had a full book. It was just amazing.
So, but how did you go about actually writing the book? What was your discipline like?
The way I write, majority of the time, I write based on experience. So I didn't have a table of contents or anything like that. I didn't know exactly what I was going to, I didn't have a list of things I was definitely going to write about. No structure, nothing. I just started writing. It's just flowing. It's flowing. And I just started writing and writing and writing based on my experience.
So did you think it, would you say it was more like a journal?
It was very therapeutic. I can't say it was like a journal because like 90% of the book is fiction and just a little bit is about what really happened to me. But I really can't say it was a journal, but maybe a little bit. It was very therapeutic to write. Very therapeutic is what I found out. I was able to release a lot of things, you know.
So, Sweetie, what is your support system like? Because obviously you can't do this alone. I mean, you took the bull by the horns, but I would imagine that you need the support of those around you.
Oh, yeah. My mom is absolutely amazing. She stood by me every step of the way, and she encouraged me to take my medication, and she encouraged me that I can be successful. Any goal I've ever said I wanted to accomplish, she said, you can do it. You can do it. And she taught me that any dream is possible. And I want to tell the audience that any dream that you have is possible. And God told me, take baby steps. Take baby steps, and that's what I've been doing. And I've been doing the impossible, and that's why a lot of people are so amazed. A lot of people are telling me, oh, no, you're not. When I do radio interviews, they say, you're not schizophrenic. They misdiagnose you. But I am paranoid schizophrenic. But a lot of people cannot believe it because of the way I look. I'm beautiful, and people have an image of what mental illness looks like, and for a lot of people, it doesn't look like me. One thing I'll say is, like, when people write textbooks, they should show a before and after, so people can realize there is hope, and you can overcome this, you know?
And do you, because I'm on your website, I don't see pictures of you with
I don't have a before and after on my website.
Because you need to, darling. That would be nice, like you said.
Yeah, my friend, one person that's been advising me, her name is Rashida Strober. She's a national playwright, plays a dark-skinned woman's revenge. And I met her about 2 years ago. She's the first person. I had my book out for 5 years and nobody helped me. He's not my preacher, not nobody. People were jealous of me. So this is the first person that ever helped me. And one thing she did say is, I need a before and after picture. But when my mom took a picture of me, I took the picture and I ripped it up because I didn't want to get rid of these things. And I wish I wouldn't have did that. Yep. I wish I wouldn't have done that.
I can see that, Swia. So, Swia, Don't Call Me Crazy, I'm Just in Love is readily available?
Yes. You can go to mentalhealthbook.org, amazon.com, barnesandnoblebook.com, and they can purchase the book. Yes.
Perfect, Swia. We'd love to keep in touch to continue with your progress in terms of getting the word out. Thank you for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Swia Mohammed, and her book is called Don't Call Me Crazy, I'm Just in Love, Diagnosed with Paranoid Schizophrenia at the Age of 28. And, of course, she hasn't been cured, if you will, but she's managing the symptoms, and she's able to be a contributing member of society. And that's something that I find very inspirational, because talk about adversity, being molested by her brother at 5, abused by her stepfather, having the brother commit suicide, such a story, and the bravery of folks that are willing to share that with us. So we had a record yesterday. Wednesday in Death Valley marked the 100th anniversary of the world's hottest day on record, which was 134 degrees Fahrenheit on July 10th, 1918. It can't be, yes, 1913. So that was the 100th anniversary of the hottest day on record, 1913. So fast forward to 2013, it was around 120 degrees yesterday. But the reason it's making the news more than what yesterday was is that there was a park ranger who took a video of a park staffer who took a video of herself cooking an egg with nothing but a skillet and the sun. Because of the hot temperatures, she posted it on the web. I don't know that it went viral, but it had a couple hundred thousand views. So visitors to the park have been doing that. But what have they been doing? They've been doing it on the sidewalk. So the park issued a plea yesterday on its Facebook page. And it says, an employee's posting of frying an egg in a pan in Death Valley was intended to demonstrate how hot it can get here, with the recommendation that if you do this, use a pan or aluminum foil and properly dispose of the contents. However, the Death Valley National Park maintenance crew has been busy cleaning up eggs cracked directly on the sidewalk, including egg cartons and shells strewn across the parking lot. This is your national park. Please put trash in the garbage or recycle bins provided, and don't crack eggs on the sidewalks or the salt playa at Badwater. So they're saying that, you know, the saying is it's hot enough to fry an egg. Well, so that's been proven, and so don't do it unless you're going to do it in a pan and you can take care of yourself. And the more that they're talking about the 120 degrees temperature in Death Valley, the more I realize how exceptional my trip last August was on my then Harley motorcycle that was a 1200 Sportster low. We went through Nevada, you know, through the desert in California, then into Nevada. It was 120 degrees as we were riding. And I'll never forget, it was our first day. We met Sunday morning last August, and the 10 of us took off. And we were in Las Vegas, Nevada at 12 noon, and it was 120 degrees. And I'm in full leathers, a full-on helmet, not any ability to drink water for two reasons. One, I didn't have a cup holder. And two, my full mask has a chin guard that doesn't allow you to sip. And I am fortunate to say that I didn't have heat stroke or anything. Three of the guys did on that day. One of them pulled over and actually got lightheaded and was vomiting on the side of the road because we stopped every 100 miles. So that meant that we could hydrate and cool down, get our cores cooled. But talk about perspiration. It was, and that's when I said to myself, what was I thinking? This is day one. I'm exposing myself to 120 degrees, and they say it's hotter than that because of the blow up from the black asphalt back up to you as you're scooting over it. This is the way I'm choosing to spend my time as a vacation. And I posted that on Facebook, and one of my girlfriends who I had visited with prior to my departure was saying, Maria, this doesn't sound like fun at all. So when I posted, what was I thinking? Here I am at high noon in Las Vegas at 120 degree plus weather on my motorcycle with full leathers and a full helmet. What was I thinking? And she says, yeah, we were wondering that too. So the George Zimmerman trial is in the news today because police and city leaders in Florida are saying that they are ready and on alert, and they're taking precautionary steps. They're hoping that they will be able to have contained protests, and they don't want people not to exercise their rights, but they don't want it to devolve into unrest. So for months, officials in Sanford, where the trial is taking place in South Florida, have been working with pastors, youth coaches, community activists, summer camp counselors to stress a nonviolent approach. And a great quote from one of the reverends, who's a longtime pastor and chairman of Miami-Dade County's Community Relations Board, Reverend Walter T. Richardson, says, "It's all right to be vocal, but we don't want to be violent. We've already lost one soul, and we don't want to lose any more." So what they've also done is they've created a public service TV ad, which features Miami Heat player James Jones. And the ad theme, the ad's theme is, "Raise your voice, not your hands," and it also stresses a nonviolent approach. "We want to make sure people have the right to protest." This is coming from the Miami-Dade Police Department's operation. The department's deputy director, Juan Perez, says, "First Amendment zones have been established in certain neighborhoods if crowds do gather, because people have the right to exercise their right to free speech. But please, let's keep it civilized. Our job is going to be to minimize those opportunities to rob a store or shoplift." So they're saying the worst rioting occurred in 1980 in the mostly black Liberty City and Overtown neighborhoods of Miami, after four white police officers were acquitted in the death of Arthur McDuffie, a black Marine Corps veteran. McDuffie was beaten to death by police trying to stop him for a traffic violation. The three-day riot, this is in 1980 numbers, killed 18 people and did some $100 million in damage. So please, everybody, let the system work. Let's let justice prevail, and let's be civilized about that. So we'd like to have our next guest on the line with us, Sylvia Fogelman. She's the president and the CEO of the Foster Family and Adoption Agency in Southern California. She's going to be joining us next.
And Wheels is back. We're raising money for Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Join us for a ride, lunch, and a souvenir t-shirt, and a donation to the cause this Sunday. Registration is just $40, and the money you help us raise helps women in our community who may be underprivileged, uninsured, or underinsured. All women, all riders. Registration is at 8:30. Kickstands up at 10 a.m. Roll into Ventura Harley-Davidson in Camarillo this Sunday and join the cause. Visit MariaSanchezShow.com for event details and register online right now. Join us this Sunday morning for the 8th annual Heels and Wheels, a women's motorcycle ride in support of Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Proudly supported by Ventura Harley-Davidson, Grand Marshal Maria Sanchez, and News Talk 1590 KBTA.
Sylvia, good morning. This is Maria Sanchez. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Just a minute, please.
Oh, okay. So there was a little confusion because we were playing our public service announcement.
Hello.
Hi, good morning, Sylvia.
Yes, this is Sylvia.
This is Maria Sanchez. Thank you for joining us this morning. Sylvia Fogelman is the president and the CEO of Southern California Foster Family and Adoption Agency. We appreciate you taking the time and to share your very important message. Thank you and good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. We were playing a public service announcement about a fundraiser that we're doing this Sunday, and so I think that confused your staff because we were on the line, but we weren't able to speak. So thank you for rolling with the punches with us. Why don't you speak, if you can, about foster family and adoption agencies throughout the country, what their goal is, and then we'll drill down to Southern California.
Okay, well, the goal of foster care is to provide a temporary kind of substitute home and family for a child whose parents are not at the moment capable of taking care of them. And generally, the reason that they come into foster care is because of neglect or abuse or abandonment. And the abuse can be physical or sexual or emotional as well. Usually emotional goes with those others. Adoption is when you provide a permanent home for a child. So once the child is in foster care, if in fact the child is not able to go back to family for whatever reason, then it's possible for either the foster parents to adopt that child or for someone else in the community who wants to adopt to be able to adopt that child.
And what is the time frame between, I'm sure you probably can only speak about California, but between being a foster parent, electing to adopt, and then actually being able to adopt or being granted the adoption?
There is no guarantee that a foster parent can adopt the child, because our first order of business is to see if we can't have that child returned to birth family.
Right.
However, in California, the law is fairly explicit about the time frames. And if a child is under the age of 4, then it should not take more than 18 months of trying to get that child back to family. And if that's not happening, allowing the foster parents to adopt.
Now, I would consider foster families to be angels, because the reality is that it's temporary, that they're going to provide love and nourishment and support, and they're just going to be transition into the reunification, because that's obviously your goal, correct?
That is the goal, and they are angels. The foster parents are unbelievable, and they have a very hard time. In fact, we've put together a support group for them, because when they take a child, they're on two different tracks, and the tracks are very, very different from each other. The one says, I'm working with the birth family and everybody to try to have this child return home. But in fact, I'm so bonded and attached to this child, I really would love to keep this child and adopt the child.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very difficult position that they're in.
Now, I know that you are here in Southern California looking for some special families, for some special foster care and or adoptions. You want to share that?
Well, most of the people who come to us would like to be able to adopt at some point, and generally want to adopt a child who's under the age of 5, which is the most difficult to be able to work with, because those are the children whom relatives really want to have come home.
Mm-hmm.
But because the child, when we say the child should return to birth family, we're not just talking about the parents. We're talking about the extended family as well.
That's a good point that you're making. So it's not necessarily the birth mother or the birth father. It's the extended family.
Exactly, exactly. And some of the children don't have that kind of family, and so it's pretty much that they're going to be adopted if they don't go home to mom or dad. But other children have large extended families, and they all have the possibility of being able to take that child home.
Sylvia, can you speak then about how to become a foster parent? What's the process, please?
The process for us is that you need to come to an orientation, and then we provide 21 hours. The orientation is 3 hours. Then we provide 21 hours of training. During that time, we really go through a lot of information. So we're not just saying, this is the paperwork you have to fill out. We're also telling people about how to behave with birth family and the importance of birth family, regardless of whether you adopt or not. We talk about the importance of attachment, about how to discipline a child in a more effective way than you might know right now. So we go through this training. We ask them to read a book about adoption, if in fact that's their goal. And then they have to fill out a myriad of paperwork, because we need to be sure that we're protecting this child who has not been protected before.
Mm-hmm.
So they do fingerprints, they get a medical, they have to do all of those kinds of things and fill out a lot of paperwork about themselves. Then they go through a family assessment. We want to know more about what is their motivation, how did they grow up, what kind of a background do they have, what are their expectations. All of those things have to come into play. So it takes us about 3 to 4 months in order to, from the time the person comes to orientation until we can certify them. And if they're not suitable, we tell them that we just don't feel as though they are the right people to take a child at this time.
Now, where are the children when they've been taken from the abusive, I'm going to use as the general term, situation, and before they're actually placed with somebody who's been through this process that you just outlined?
The goal is to place them immediately. So the Department of Children and Family Services, with whom we contract, will call us, and they will say, we just took in custody an 11-year-old girl. And then they tell us more about the background of the child, and if we have a family with whom that would be a logical and caring match, we make that match. If we cannot do it, they go to another agency.
So do you, when one applies to become a foster parent, are you certified or cleared for certain age groups, or is it from birth to 18, or how does that work? I.e., if you...
Be birth to 17 if you want to. But we ask people in the course of the home study, what would be most comfortable for you? And in the course of that, they tell us, well, you know, I really would prefer to have a child who's newborn or who's under the age of 5, or I would like to have an adolescent come and stay with me. So we go with what people feel most comfortable with what they can do.
And then... I understand that Los Angeles County has the largest caseload of children in the country.
That's true.
Okay.
There are about 35,000 children under the jurisdiction of the Department of Children and Family Services, and about 27,000 of those children are under the court's jurisdiction. The court is involved. You know, we have a big dependency court here in Los Angeles, and it's over in Monterey Park, and they have jurisdiction over these cases.
Now, what about language? Is that an issue?
Well, it's not an issue for us. We cannot take children who don't speak English.
Okay.
Because we don't really have the capability of handling that. But there are agencies that have Spanish-speaking families and Spanish-speaking social workers. We have a couple of social workers who can speak Spanish, but we don't feel as though we can really deal with that situation.
And can you describe a typical scenario when a child is taken from a home, and where do they go, and then how are they placed, and what's that like, and who finesses that? And I mean, because they've obviously been taken from a traumatic situation, and they eventually land into the homes of one of the folks that you've already screened. But what is the child going through in that process in terms of their experience?
The experience of a child is traumatic. And depending upon the age and what's happened, it varies in terms of the intensity of that. But they're always in a traumatic situation. What happens, well, I can give you an example of yesterday. We had
Please.
A call. The mom had this child, birthed this child 4 months ago, and was able to take the child home. It looked as though she was going to be off drugs and everything would be all right. Turns out she's not really off drugs. The child's 4 months old. The child is being neglected. The department goes out. They find that this is the case. They called us and said, do you have a home for a four-month-old baby? And we said, yes, we do. The department's social worker then has the child in custody, brings the child directly to our foster home, and gives that child over to our foster parent, who is already certified to be able to handle this age-level child.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it goes. And then 3 days later, the court hears the case. So the county social worker has to provide a case scenario to the court and say, we feel this child should be in custody for the following reasons. And the court decides, yes, the child should stay in custody, or no, the child should go back home. And when the child is placed, we then go out the next day. I have a cadre of social workers, and they have 15 cases on their caseload. They go out and visit on a regular basis, and they will see that child within 24 hours and make sure that everything is okay.
So in that example, Sylvia, that you shared, which just happened yesterday, so thank you for its relevance, that baby obviously needs formula and diapers and clothing and who knows what kind of issues in terms of if it was exposed to drugs in utero and that sort of thing. How does your system help in that Like, no, I mean, having four babies myself, having had four babies, I know that formulas vary. So if you had one and then you automatically give another one, there's, I would imagine, reactions, maybe if there's allergies, et cetera. So who helps with that transition?
Yeah, the social worker who picks up the child needs to find out what kind of formula that child is getting. The children who are in foster care are all eligible for WIC, Women, Infant, and Children's Program. And so the formula can be gotten free of charge from the WIC stores. We tell our foster parents, if they're single or if they're a couple, you need to make sure that you have a support system so that one person is home to accept the child and the other person is out there getting what's necessary.
Yeah.
If they have a few hours, you know, so we call them at 3 p.m, the child's going to be coming to them somewhere around 6 or 7 o'clock at night. We tell them, now, go. And they have to go out, get the formula, get the diapers that are appropriate for that age and sex, and get ready.
And obviously they have to have all the crib and the high chair and the car seat and all that, right?
Definitely have to have the car seat, definitely have to have the crib.
And the baby carrier. And then suddenly, if they're both a working couple, then they're all of a sudden confronted with child care issues.
Well, we tell them ahead of time, if you want a very young child, you better research the child care in your neighborhood, make arrangements that child care is suitable and that you can use them. But when a child comes to you, you need to take off a couple of weeks and be with that child, because that child has just suffered from trauma, from separation, all of that sort of thing. The child needs to get used to you personally.
Mm-hmm.
So don't expect that tomorrow you're going to be off working.
Right.
Tomorrow you're going to be at home with that child.
Now, Sylvia, I would imagine that the older children, say from 5 on up, who have been in abusive situations, they also have special issues. And psychologically, there must be, is that part of your orientation process and your 21 hours of training? Because I wouldn't know what to do with an abused child. I would imagine there's trust issues, abandonment issues, you know, acting
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We tell people it's going to take between 3 and 6 months before the child and they really have stabilized, because it will take a little bit of time. An abused child isn't just going to walk into your house and say, oh, thank you for rescuing me.
Right.
That child is going to be angry. That child's going to be upset. And you have to be able to just go with the flow. If you cannot do that, this is the wrong place for you to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the older the children, probably the more they've been through.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a therapist on staff, and we provide therapy. So what will happen is, a few days after the child comes in, we will have our social worker out there. You know, first she's out there within 24 hours. Then she'll be out there about a week later and start the assessment process. Okay, so what does this child need? Does the child need therapy? We always take them for medical and dental. So we do this kind of assessment to see what do we need to do to help this child to thrive.
And then when and if and how often is the child exposed back to their birth family?
Well, we need to be very positive about the birth family, because they're not horrible people. For whatever reason, something happened that caused them to be abusive, or it might not be they who were abusive. It might be a boyfriend, a husband, whatever. So we instill in our foster parents that they need to be positive. This is where the child came from, and we cannot be negative about their parents, because it then translates to being negative about the child. And if the child is going back, the child has to feel positive about their parents. The court orders visitation. So it might order 1 hour 3 times a week. It could order 3 hours 3 times a week. So the child does have visitation with the parents, because the goal is for the child to go back to this family.
And who facilitates that coming and going, the transportation?
the transportation has to be facilitated by the foster parents, which is always a bit of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of them are working. But we do most of the monitoring of the visits, because all the visits have to be monitored.
So that it's supervised.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Yeah. And then, Sylvia, we've got about a minute left. You want to talk about the LGBT aspect of fostering?
I sure do. About half of our parents are LGBT. We welcome everybody who's committed to children. So it could be a single person, a same-sex couple, an older couple, a younger couple, whatever. And what we're looking for right now, which is most critical, is homes for LGBT teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
People will shy away from teenagers in general, and particularly shy away from teenagers who are a little bit different from them. So we're looking for homes for the LGBT kids. And Southern California Foster Family and Adoption Agency had been in the forefront of welcoming LGBT parents, and now we're trying to really get the kids taken care of.
Well, thank you, Sylvia, for what you do, for what your agency is doing, and for your time this morning, and for illuminating us about what the process is, and hopefully gaining more awareness.
That would be wonderful. We really do want to gain more awareness. And our telephone number is 888-888-1183 for anyone who wants to contact us.
And we'll post that later today when we post the podcast, as well as your scffaa.org website information, too.
That would be great. Thank you.
Sylvia, thank you, thank you, thank you. Appreciate your time.
You're quite welcome. Pleased to talk to you.
And me, too. Sylvia Fogelman, President and CEO of the Foster Family and Adoption Agency in Southern California. Our time is up. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great day. Today's my dad's 84th birthday, and we will visit with you mañana.
Give you some